If your friend's friend's friend jumped off the Empire State Building, would you do it too? Well, the answer might surprise and disappoint your mother, because research shows that we are highly affected by the members of our social network, even those members with whom we don't come into direct contact. Back in September, I spoke to Dr. Nicholas Christakis and Dr. James Fowler about their book, Connected, which looked into those networks and the rules that govern them. Listeners told us how much they enjoyed the segment, and we thought we would air it for you again on this extended holiday weekend. I started off by asking the doctors, was the message of their book really that we would jump off the building if our friends did it too?
You know, my son is with me here in New York, and we're going up there, and so I'm hopeful that there aren't any contagion effects at the top of the Empire State Building.
Well, let's address the immediate controversy. When your research was reported on the front page of the New York Times a couple of years ago, it claimed that if your friends get fat, so do you, even if those friends are thousands of miles away. And I know people are still discussing this today. I go to parties, and they're still arguing over it. But how can that be explained?
I think the key thing to realize is that what matters is how we are connected to each other, and what matters is who you know, not where you are. So you're much more influenced by the people with whom you interact, and the people with whom they interact, and the people with whom they interact, than you are by total strangers. That is to say, by people that you bump into in the street, for example.
Or people on the bus or something like that, right?
So what it's about is it's about the fact that we're all embedded in these social networks, that I'm connected to you and you to others, and there's things that flow through the network and that affect us.
So do thin people tend to associate with other thin people, and well, people who have more weight tend to associate with heavier people?
Yes, that's true, but that's not what the claim is. It's in addition to that, it's people who gain weight. The gaining of weight can cause the gaining of weight in others, or the loss of weight can cause the loss of weight in others.
So do you feel responsible for all those women who dumped their pudgy pals and went in search of thinner companions?
I personally don't feel responsible for that, because in every interview that we had when that paper came out, I said, every friend makes you healthier. And that got lost. I think there are a lot of people that didn't realize that when we compare the people in our studies who dumped their friends to the people who kept them are the ones who actually end up being healthier.
So but even if it were true that there was a benefit to cut the ties to people who had gained weight, for instance, any benefit of that was counteracted by the cost of losing a friend.
Does it matter whether the friends are male or female, or of your own sex?
For this, in this case, yes, it does. So sometimes these influences, the gender is relevant, and sometimes not. In the case of weight gain, what we find is that people seem to be influenced by people around them who have the same gender. So when a man, for example, is deciding what is an acceptable body size, he looks at other men, and women look at other women, and not crosswise.
We also find this for emotions like happiness, for example. Again, it seems like the same gender relationships are stronger, and the stronger the relationship, the more likely you are to be influenced by somebody else.
Although I have been in a situation where I was with a woman who just was concerned about my weight and let me know it every opportunity.
While it How'd that annoyed, work for you?
Well, it annoyed me, but at the same time, I lost weight.
There you go. She had a big impact on you.
You're a doctor, Nicholas. Yes. Was your original introduction to social networks related to healthcare?
Yeah. I mean, I was I'm trained both as a physician and as a social scientist. And as a physician, I used to and still do take care of people who are dying. I'm a hospice doctor. And in the 1990s, I was working at Chicago taking care of people who are dying and doing research on a very old problem in the social sciences called the widower effect, or dying of a broken heart. So here, if my wife dies, my risk of death might double for the first year. And that, if you look at it, is the simplest possible example of a network effect, a dyadic person-to-person kind of effect, a non-biological spread of illness or disease. And that's how I became interested in this general problem of how things spread in networks originally.
But you say there's also a racial component in that.
In the widower effect?
Yes.
Yeah, we've done some work looking at that. What we find is that this is work we had done jointly with my colleague Felix Eltwert. We find that that there is a widower effect in whites, but not in African Americans.
And why would that be?
It's a very good question. I don't know how much time you want to spend on it.
Want to devote the whole show to it.
I understand. So the gist of it is the following. When people enter into marriage, their risk of death declines. And so it's a good thing to be married. If we could randomly assign men to be married to randomly chosen women, the men would gain about 7 years to their lives. And if we could randomly assign women to be married to randomly chosen men, My wife says it would take away 7 years from a woman's lives, but it actually it adds two years to a woman's life, so they don't benefit as much. Whites and blacks both benefit upon entry into marriage, and then when white members die, they pay a price, but blacks don't pay a price upon exit. And the reason, we think, is that black families continue to provide support to, on average, to the bereaved person in a way that white families don't.
Yeah, now, must it be a legal marriage, or are we talking about...
No, any long-term union, yeah.
James, you were looking at contagious effects in politics.
That's right. They thought I was a little crazy at the time, I think, because in political science, we have this question that a lot of people don't really think is a question, which is, why do we vote? Most people, when they hear me ask that question, they say, well, isn't the right question, why don't we vote? And so the way political scientists think about this is they think about this election we just had in 2000. It's the closest election, presidential election that we've had in U.S. history. And yet, the 700-person margin that decided the election in Florida, if any one of those 700 people had changed what they did, the outcome would have been identical. And so the question is, why would any one person, knowing that there's only like a 1 in 10 million chance that they themselves will decide the outcome of an election, why would they vote? And so I started thinking about this question of, well, it doesn't make sense to think about this as an individual decision. And I thought about that commercial from the 1970s, that Breck shampoo commercial, where the woman gets so happy about her shampoo that she tells two friends, and then they tell two friends, and so on and so on. And pretty soon, hundreds of these women are using the shampoo on the screen. And it occurred to me...
This was science being influenced by...
Pop culture. You know, you can find ideas for science everywhere. But so it occurred to me that we really were thinking about the problem in the wrong way, that when it comes to politics, we're making these decisions based on not only our own choices, but how those choices influence others.
Well, what does the Obama campaign tell us about these kinds of networks, and what do more recent protests against some Obama policies tell us about this sort of thing?
Yeah, so we talk about in the book that one of the successes of the Obama campaign, people think that it was because Obama could use the internet to connect directly to his donors and to his constituents. And in fact, the argument that we make in the book is that what he did was he was able to get them to connect to each other. And time and again, what we find in these networks is that we're more influenced by people who themselves have a connection to one another than we are by people who are disconnected from one another.
So how did Anthony Downs apply the science of rationality to the study of politics? I thought there was something of an oxymoron.
Yeah, so rationality. When people think of rationality, the last thing they think of is politics. But there's been a lot of economists who have tried to apply this very strict reasoning, these mathematical models, to how people make decisions. And Anthony Downs was one of these people who wrote a book in the 50s. It's very, very popular and sort of started this trend going. And unfortunately, what that has done is it has moved us away from thinking about the politics of networks. Because in these mathematical models, you can't get things to work if you include the fact that one person cares about another person or one person influences another person. And so it's sort of like it's the method that's driving the science rather than the other way around.
And in fact, what we would say is that a lot of the study of lots of social phenomena, lots of social problems has been misguided, because what it does is it takes this vast problem and it reduces it as to the actions of individuals. But actually what really matters is how individuals interact.
Well, recently I had a guest here talking about outbreaks of dancing epidemics on the Rhine in the 15th century.
We talk about that too in the book, actually.
I know. Yeah. That's why I'm bringing it up. Yeah. You also talk about the laughter epidemic in Tanzania in 1962 and something that happened with Triborough Bridge employees in New York City in 1990. This is called psychogenic illness?
Mass psychogenic illness is the example we discussed there, which is it used to be called epidemic hysteria, which is a kind of...
Which is a much easier to understand phrase.
Yeah, but it's more provocative. It's a more poetic phrase, but it's a more provocative phrase. The technical term is now MPI, mass psychogenic illness. And the basic idea is that what's spreading from person to person is anxiety. And when that happens is you can get these astonishing phenomena like these dancing manias in medieval England, or this laughter epidemic in Africa that we talk about, or the epidemic that affected the fainting epidemic that affected the Triborough Bridge employees, or other epidemics in schools that are still happening. Or frankly, there was just an example in Afghanistan recently of girls' schools closures where there was epidemics that were spreading of psychological illness.
You also have bank runs, for example. We talk about the Northern Rock bank run in England, and it was pretty clear there that people didn't think the bank would fail. They thought that other people thought the bank would fail. And their anxiety about that was really what was driving their behavior rather than, you know, some kind of rational decision-making process.
Now, must they know each other, or do they just have to be in the same social milieu?
So it depends. But so all of these examples, though, are examples that it's very hard to understand these phenomena if you just study individuals, right? You have to study the whole groups of people. So trying to understand the problem by reducing it to the actions of individuals makes you miss – it's like looking at the trees rather than the forest. But do they have to know each other? It depends on the circumstances. For James and I are often misunderstood as somehow saying that everything spreads in networks. That's not true. And not everything that spreads in networks spreads the same way. They're different mechanisms. And different things spread across different kinds of ties, friendship, spousal, intimate, non-intimate ties, and so forth. So the answer to your question is, it depends on the circumstances.
Right. So just for example, happiness, we find, spreads between next-door neighbors. Obesity does not. Apparently, with obesity, you really, in order to have your behavior influence, you need to have a deep, close social connection. But emotional contagion, you can have a less strong relationship with someone and sort of catch somebody else's mood.
My guests are James Fowler, who is associate professor of at the University of California, San Diego, in the Department of Political Science and the Center for Wireless and Population Health Systems, and Nicholas Christakis, who is a professor at Harvard University with joint appointments in the Department of Healthcare Policy, Sociology, and Medicine. And together they have written Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. It's published by Little Brown. We'll continue our conversation after this. You can take a peek inside our studios with guests like former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, historian Taylor Branch, and actors Bill Pullman and Julia Stiles. Just go to our show page and click on Photos. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from Wiley, publishers of So Easy by Ellie Krieger. Simple, light, and nutrition-packed recipes for every meal of the week. Available in bookstores now. 92nd Street Y Talks. This Wednesday, Howie Mandel, TV host and author of Here's the Deal, Don't Touch Me, speaks with Dr. Gail Saltz about living with obsessive-compulsive disorder. Tickets at 92y.org/talks. Do Not Go Gentle. Written and directed by Leon Pownall. Playing at the Clermont, 410 West 42nd Street, November 19th through January 10th. More information at donotgogentle.com.
A whole decade has passed, and no one has ever named it, except these callers to The Brian Lehrer Show.
The Greedies. The Greedies will do nicely for the decade. We are just wrapping up.
Instead of the zero zeros, I was called the uh-ohs.
Marie in Flatbush and Mike in Suffolk calling in last week. On our next program, we'll go searching for the perfect name for the last 10 years. That's The Brian Lehrer Show, weekdays at 10 a.m. on WNYC.
We're back with an interview I conducted this past September with Drs. Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler. They were on the show to talk about their book, Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. And we are replaying that conversation for you now on this extended Thanksgiving weekend. I asked them how they wound up being connected despite the fact that they live on opposite ends of the country.
Right. So we overlapped at Harvard. Nicholas had just come from the University of Chicago and started a new job there. And I was a graduate student sort of searching these crazy ideas about how politics is influenced by these network effects. And my advisor heard Nicholas give his talk, his spiel about how what he really wanted to do was find out whether or not these things like the widower effect not only affect spouses, but spouses' friends, neighbors, and so on. And as soon as he heard that, he said, oh, my God, these two guys are talking about the same thing. You guys need to work together.
Well, how some. So we started out. I mean, in fact, we're a proof of the pudding of the book. I mean, we were friends of friends when we met, and then we were introduced and wound up doing something unusual.
It's a social network story.
Yeah.
Have some of your findings been in operation without having been categorized? Don't many people aspire to go to elite schools because of the contacts that they'll make there and the success of the alumni networks, which will give them a potential benefit?
Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of institutions that have existed since time immemorial in human society whose whole purpose, in fact, is to foster the kind of creation of ties between people that might benefit them. People do introductions all the time, and these old boy networks, in a way, function for this purpose. And we talk about that in the book. We talk about interlocking boards. We talk about the kinds of institutional arrangements that foster ties.
How much control do we have over the network that we're in or our ability to be in a certain kind of network.
Well, it's interesting that you ask that because I think people believe that they have complete control over their networks. But one of the things that we talk about in the book is the evolutionary basis of our networks, including some new evidence that our position in networks is in part determined by our genes. And I think this is a very new idea for most people, although I think that if you ask people, they would tell you that really some people have a personality to attract more friends than other people. Some people have a personality to be at the center of a network, the life of a party, and other people are wallflowers. And as a consequence of this genetic variation, it implies that the shape of our networks is going to be very different than, say, a network that's deliberately constructed in order to achieve some kind of goal.
So if I have a second, I'd like to evoke an image in your listeners' minds, which is if they've seen pictures of these networks, imagine that you have this network and it looks like a jumble of Christmas tree lights, which is what they often look like, a little knot in the middle with these little tendrils that stretch out to the edge. Every light is a person and the wires connecting the lights are people. And now I'm going to ask you, would you rather be a light in the middle, a person in the middle of the network, or a person on the edge of the network if a deadly germ is spreading through the network? And the answer is people would say, I'd rather be on the edge because in the middle I'm going to be buffeted on all sides by this pathogen. On the other hand, imagine that a juicy piece of gossip were spreading through the network. Now you'd rather be in the middle. And so it matters where you are in the network, even if you only have two or three friends, no matter where you are.
What does this all tell us about the spread of sexually transmitted diseases?
Well, I mean, the
sex... Do they help us understand the risk?
Yeah, of course it does. But and in fact, one of the things about the spread of STDs is that it is for social network science. Having a sex with someone is for social network science what dying is for most medical studies. It's what's known as a hard endpoint. So if I want to sort of discern whether I have a connection with someone else, knowing whether you've had sex with that person is pretty definitive proof that there is a connection between these two people. And you can map out sexual networks, and we do in the book, and it turns out the structure of the sexual network has big implications for exactly how the germ can spread. And we talk about an epidemic of syphilis that broke out in teenagers in this sort of white bread community in the southern United States. And what we show actually in that case is that really what's happening is in that case is that the sexually transmitted disease is actually an epiphenomenon. What's really important is that there's an epidemic of social norms that permit teenage sex, and then the STD, let's say, kicks in and then spreads through the network as well.
You say that a person's future spouse is likely to be your friend's friend, but is that true in the age of internet dating?
Well, that's an interesting question. It does appear that more people are meeting their spouses online and certainly, you know, dating online. But we talk about in the book the fact that this online life is really not going to be that much different than the social networks that we've had for hundreds of thousands of years. And so going forward, we would expect that the 70% or so of people who meet through their social networks, they're going to continue to use the internet not just to access strangers, but to be better in touch with their friends' friends, and their friends' friends.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize something James just said, which is that we show in our book, data work done by others, that most people wind up marrying a friend of a friend or a friend or a friend of a friend of a friend, somewhere within 3 degrees of separation. And so what that means is that if you're single right now, your future spouse, you might have about 10,000 people that are within 3 degrees removed from you, assuming that the relationships are of a certain intensity. And one of those people is your future spouse. And you haven't met them yet.
But Kevin Bacon's already married.
Yeah, Kevin Bacon's
already
married.
That's 6 degrees, right? Everyone's
that's a different thing.
By six
yeah.
degrees, not three.
Yeah. Well, does this apply to gay people as well as straight people?
Meeting your future spouse?
But,
yes, of course.
And all of the other things that...
Yes, of course.
We think so, right? So the data that we personally have been studying doesn't have enough information about same-sex relationships for us to state with certainty that these effects apply to them, but we have no reason to think that they wouldn't.
What did the Framingham Heart Study tell you about the decline of smoking over the last 40 years?
In the Framingham study, what we found that was particularly interesting was that the behavior actually influenced the structure of the network. So starting in the 1970s, no one really cared whether or not you smoked or not. There was no social stigma attached to it. And what we found was that starting in the 1980s, that smokers actually started getting pushed to the outside of their social circles. So much so that we have these measures of how central people are, you know, how much they're the life of the party. And smokers really literally crashed to zero by the end of the study. There was so much stigma going on that became polarized, sort of like the polarization between Democrats and Republicans in the Congress today.
It reminds me of that New Yorker cartoon where people are all smoking outside of a restaurant and a guy says, I'm going to go inside and get some fresh air.
That's exactly right. And that really evokes another important point, which is that we would expect there to be limits to our ability to reach these people, because once they're all huddled and all doing the same behavior, it's going to reinforce and it's going to be hard for us to get in touch with them via non-smokers.
In fact, what we found in the smoking study is that in a very deep way, smokers quit in droves. Whole large groups of interconnected people who don't necessarily even know each other will quit simultaneously in the network. And then in some sense, you can understand smoking cessation behavior in human populations the way we might study the flocking of birds or the schooling of fish, and that the whole flock suddenly shifts and moves to the left, and that's what happens with smoking as well.
What about with drinking?
We're studying drinking as well. That work is being reviewed right now. What
similar
we talked about in the book
there, yeah,
is that, yeah, there's similar things going on.
But drinking is less stigmatized these days, isn't it? Only alcoholism is stigmatized.
Well, right, and I think it's because it's still an open question about how much drinking we should do, right? So there are some people that some doctors that think that we shouldn't drink at all, some doctors that think that we should drink a moderate amount. And as it turns out, it's that sort of that sweet spot, that moderate amount that really pivots things in comparison to, say, the smoking epidemic, where everybody sort of realizes that smoking is bad for you.
Can we explain the things that so many people were confused about with Bernard Madoff's Ponzi scheme through discussing this, why so many people were willing to go along even though so many alarm bells should have gone off?
Okay, so there are two ways that our work could shed light on things like Ponzi schemes. One is this influence process that you alluded to, and the other is a more structural understanding. So one of the things we talk about in the book, and most of your listeners will know this, is a telephone tree. Is an everyday network that we human beings organize. I call two people, each of them calls two people, and each of them calls two people. This can rapidly disseminate information about a school closure very effectively. But you can actually use that same architecture, turn it on its head, and vacuum up money. So instead of information flowing from 1 to 2, from 2 to 4, and from 4 to 8, and so forth, instead you have money flowing from 16 to 8 and on up the thing. And so the same kind of ideas, the same kind of way of designing networks can be exploited for ill purposes as well.
And I think people have that intuition, and so that whenever you're trying to recruit one of these people into the scheme, what you're doing is you're showing them the pyramid, and you're saying, look, you can be the tip of the pyramid. And people don't really realize that they're not the tip of the pyramid,
they're the
base,
right,
of the pyramid.
Aren't close friends more influential than friends of friends?
Well, yes, absolutely. Yes. That's exactly what our studies show. And especially when it comes to behavior, I think we were a little bit misunderstood. There were, you know, pictures of, you know, some guy in the street holding a McDonald's bag sneezing and another guy being afraid that he was going to catch obesity. And that's not what we were saying at all.
We're saying, God bless you, in a guy in New York sneezing and somebody in Los Angeles saying, Gesundheit.
Yeah, maybe so. So, but what we were saying is that what we found was that spouses matter, siblings matter, and your closest friend matters. Right, and so it's these deep, close social contexts through which behavior can spread.
Can you? What about Stanley Milgram's sidewalk experiment? How does that apply?
Yeah, so that's a very famous. Stanley Milgram was very famous for a number of experiments. He did that experiment on Nazi obedience. He did that experiment on 6 degrees of separation, and he did this experiment where he had these crowds of people in New York of different size stop and look up at a random window, and then he saw, and those crowds were his own friends working for him, and then he had measured how many people walking by did what the crowd did depending on how big the crowd was. And, of course, the bigger the crowd, the more likely people were to copy that stupid behavior.
But it didn't take that many, right? It only took a couple, and then all of a sudden everybody was doing it.
And kids, teenagers like to do this all the time as a game.
Is that right? I didn't know that. Is that a New York thing?
My guests have been Nicholas A. Christakis and James H. Fowler, who have network to collaborate on a book called Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. It is published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having
us.
Thank you. I'll be back on Monday with another live show, and we will start off by looking at the struggles of runaway teens. Then an identical twin talks about the identity problems that many identical twins face. Also, a look at the new documentary called Loot about art masterpieces stolen during World War II and choreographer Twyla Tharp on the creative process. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Barbara Kahn, Fran Jacobs, and Stephanie Bernhardt. Dimitri Krasny was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPage, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.